Right, our final case this morning is Burke versus City of Tahlequah, 19-7056. Mr. Blakemore, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Bob Blakemore. I represent the estate of Dominic Rollis. In this case, we are the appellant. It's an appeal of a grant of qualified immunity on a use of deadly force case to two City of Tahlequah police officers, Lieutenant Vick and Officer Gardner. It's actually, I believe, a pretty straightforward case. There is dash cam video, body cam video that I hope that the courts have the opportunity to review that captures most of the relevant facts in this case. It's our position that the district court erred in granting summary judgment, as we believe that the evidence sufficiently shows for the purposes of summary judgment that a reasonable jury could find facts supporting a violation of constitutional right that was clearly established at the time of defendant's conduct. The use of deadly force is justified under the Fourth Amendment only if a reasonable officer in the defendant's position would have probable cause to believe that there was an immediate threat of serious physical harm to themselves or others. And it's been specifically established, and this is a quote from the case that we cite in the briefing, Walker versus City of Orem. It's been specifically established that where an officer has reason to believe that the suspect was holding only a knife, not a gun, and the suspect was not charging the officer and had made no slicing or stabbing motions toward him, that it was unreasonable for the officer to use deadly force against that suspect. Applying those principles, Lieutenant Vick and Officer Gardner used objectively unreasonable and excessive force in this case. In particular, at the time that he was shot by Lieutenant Vick and Officer Gardner, Mr. Rollis was, quote, armed only with a hammer from his garage. He did not charge or lunge at the officers, made no swinging or slashing motion toward them. It was clearly established by August 12, 2016, when this incident occurred, that the use of deadly force under such circumstances is unlawful. Without justification, Lieutenant Vick and Officer Gardner shot this man dead in his garage who committed no serious crime. The grant of summary judgment should be reversed.
The position of the defendants in this case is that Mr. Rollis was brandishing the hammer, that he was waving it and looked like he was about to throw it. Assuming for a minute that a jury could view the body cam evidence and conclude that, would you agree that they could use deadly force?
Well, I think, Your Honor, I think that that's the classic issue of fact for the jury to decide. I think that is it possible that a jury could interpret the video that way? Yes, but for the purposes of summary judgment, at the very least, a jury could conclude that the evidence shows merely that Mr. Rollis was moving the hammer back behind his head in a defensive stance.
He also not only moved it laterally, he also moved it vertically. He moved it up, right?
He moved it up, and the second that he moved the hammer up, the two officers began shooting.
Began yelling at him.
Well, right. When
he moved it up, they shot. Right. Right.
But he actually moved the hammer in this direction, again, without slashing, without throwing. And it's our interpretation, again, of the evidence, and I think a reasonable jury could find that that's just a defensive stance, that it was at that moment that they began using deadly force.
In your argument, you said that he was in his garage. In fact, he wasn't in his garage, was he? He was in the garage of his ex-wife, who had called the police and asked them to remove him. How does that affect your analysis in terms of, you know, he was trespassing?
Yeah, yes and no. I think that when you look at the entirety of the record, at about 6 o'clock, he was at the house of his ex-wife, at his former house. He still had possessions there, including tools in the garage. She'd allowed him to be there. And then he actually even lent him her car. He took the car longer than she had anticipated, came back around 9 o'clock. She believed that he was intoxicated. And it was at that moment that she did call 911 and say, rather calmly, if you've heard the 911 call, that, my ex-husband's in the garage. I think he's drunk. He won't leave. And that was the extent of it.
And it's going to get ugly quick, right?
She did that, yeah. So essentially, there's a couple of issues. One of the issues that we have with the district court's decision is on the first and the third factors of the Graham v. Connor test, where he actually says that the court found that those factors favored the plaintiff, but then really didn't circle back and include that in any way or give it any weight in his in the court's decision. It's our position that there was no reasonable suspicion to even search Mr. Rollis under the circumstances, let alone probable cause to arrest. And that goes directly to the issue of whether the officers conduct themselves was reasonable in how they handled this and whether or not their own conduct under Allen versus Muskogee contributed to this situation.
May I probe that with regard to Sevios and Allen? So it seems like you have two separate windows of time, them entering the garage and then them when they're confronting Mr. Rollis when he raises the hammer. So now you're getting at the first window of time when they enter the garage. In Sevios, the majority interpreted Allen to say that in Allen, of course, the guy has a gun. He's not hurting anybody. And the officers rush up and start yelling at him. An officer reaches in. And Sevios likens that case to the 6'6" man swinging a baseball bat in his driveway and says that under Allen, it would be unreasonable to precipitously provoke this erratically behaving man and create this danger. Now, what case law, including Allen, including Sevios, would suggest that it was clearly established that they get this call? You just pointed out that the 911 call doesn't express any alarm. They have no reason to think that this guy is like this baseball bat wielding man in Sevios or like the fellow in his driveway holding a gun, suicidal in Allen. They have no reason to suspect that this is going to escalate. They walk calmly into the garage. At that juncture, would you agree that they haven't done anything remotely like Sevios or Allen, correct? At that point, when they enter the garage?
Yes, sir. At that point in time, I mean, we do believe it was inappropriate for them to ask him for the search. He did not consent to the search. Then he goes into his garage. It's our position at that point, you know,
they may have committed a constitutional Fourth Amendment violation, but I think you're acknowledging that they haven't. Obviously, this is not an unreasonable search case. It's a unreasonable force case, but they haven't at that juncture precipitously provoked him to creating a confrontation like Sevios or Allen. right?
No, it's at the point that they enter the garage, back him into the, essentially back him into the garage, and then he picks up the hammer, and it's at that point that I think it just completely got out of control with the
right. And what case would have alerted these officers that if you have someone raising a hammer with that looks like you can tell from the video that it's in fairly close proximity, that whether he's not moving it, but he is, I mean, it is what it is, so to speak. You can tell that he's raising the hammer. They're in close proximity. What case would have alerted them to say that it's unreasonable to shoot at that juncture?
Unreasonable to shoot?
Right.
Well, I think...
Told them when they've been yelling at him, you know, to put it down. He doesn't, and he raises it. So what case? You know, Walker's not that case, is it? Walker's the guy, isn't he in the neighborhood? And even Sebios doesn't rely on Walker. What case would have alerted them that it was unreasonable when he refused to drop the hammer to shoot?
Oh, I think it is. I think it is Walker, and as cited in Walker, it's Zuchel versus Denver, which are both cases. Again, what we're talking about is we're not talking about a gun. We're talking about a primitive. I wouldn't even say weapon. It's a tool. I mean, it's his hammer in his garage. Okay, so it's not a. We're not talking about a man with a gun. It's at most a primitive weapon. And similar to the box cutter and Walker, or what they believed to be a knife in Zuchel, it turned out to be a nail clipper. And I think that statement, again, from Walker is specific enough. It's not at the high degree of generality of just citing the three Graham factors. It's specific enough that it put them on notice that if the suspect has this type of primitive a tool or weapon and is not threatening the officers with it, not charging them, not making a stabbing or slicing motion, then it's unconstitutional to use deadly force in that
circumstance. Mr. Blakemore, could I just zero back in on the video for a minute? As to the question whether Mr. Rawlis was assuming a defensive posture or a hostile one, is it your position that the video unambiguously shows that it was just defensive, or are you saying that there's some ambiguity about that?
I believe it is unambiguous, but I would concede that that somebody else could maybe come to a different determination on that. And again, that's a classic issue of fact. And the courts, even in qualified immunity on summary judgment, are still to examine the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. In this case, that didn't happen because it's a very reasonable interpretation. I think unambiguous is that this, as they're closing in on him and he's saying, no, I didn't do anything wrong. He's in his garage. They're closing in on him, yelling at him with their guns drawn. The other officer Reed with his taser kind of closing in on him, that this was more of like a defensive, motion and at the very least a reasonable jury, could find that. And I see my time is almost up. Maybe I'll reserve the last 25 seconds in case for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wood.
Yes, may it please the court. Scott Wood here representing Lieutenant Brandon Vick and Officer Joshua Gerdner. Since we have a video in this case and the facts seem to be very little in controversy, I will jump right to the lick log about the law. Mr. Blackmore mentioned a moment ago the Walker versus Orem case, which was decided in 2006. That case is so factually different than this case. That case involved a call to the police to try to get the police to help a family find their suicidal son who was missing, reportedly unarmed. The police are at the home of the callers later on. The son pulls in the driveway. The police are present. Apparently, the son gets out with a two-inch knife or a blade that's 2 inches long, holding it to his wrist. And according to the witnesses, the police officer shot and killed him from a distance of 28 feet away. That is not this case.
Well, there are some similarities. I mean, we're, in both instances, we're dealing with someone who is not currently in possession of all of his faculties. Here they know that this guy's intoxicated, right?
I would agree with that to a certain
degree. And while they not 28 feet away, they're still pretty far away unless you're dealing with Thor the Thunder God to throw a hammer. And isn't the overarching rule that before you can use deadly force, you've got to be at risk yourself of deadly force?
Yes, or serious bodily injury.
Right. And, so he's got a hammer. He's going to have to throw it 8 to 10 feet based on the video. I mean, that would take a lot of force to throw it. If the guy charged at him with the hammer, I think you have a right to shoot. But it seems to me it was pretty precipitous to shoot him when he doesn't have a weapon that can easily reach you and he's not coming towards you.
Your Honor, I don't know if you do a lot of home repairs or not, but a 2.5-pound framing hammer could probably be thrown 30 feet or 40 feet by a man like Dominic Rawlis. And in this case, in that enclosed garage, 8 to 10 feet away, absolutely one lucky throw and the officer gets hit in the head, it could kill him. I don't mean to argue with you about that, or the fact that it's so close that that's literally two steps that the suspect would have to take before he could get to Officer Gerdner. So I would have to respectfully disagree with you about that aspect of it. About
is it enough that the jury should get to decide?
No, I mean, there's a district court, a Tenth Circuit opinion that says a dangerous weapon is any weapon that can deliver a serious bodily injury or a death. And a claw hammer posed in such a way that Mr. Rawlis seemingly was prepared to use it would certainly give that indication to a reasonable officer on the scene.
Go ahead, Judge.
Well, let me link the video to the colloquy you've been having with Judge McHugh. Unless the video clearly shows otherwise, don't we need to accept the plaintiff's version of the events that Mr. Rawlis did not take hostile action?
No, I don't think you need to do that, because if an officer makes a reasonable mistake or errantly believes that the person is being hostile instead of holding the hammer in a defensive motion, they're also entitled to have their use of force found to be constitutional. This court has made recent decisions. I think one of them was the Padilla versus Dodge case. It was a recent case where the court talks about you don't have to wait until you see the glint of steel before taking action, because if you wait longer than that, it may be too late. And I think that also comes out of the estate of Larson versus Merkes.
But in Pia versus Dodge, the court also made a clear distinction between Allen and Ceballos, saying that when the officers are aware they're dealing with an impaired or emotionally distraught individual, they have a heightened obligation than when they're dealing with someone who's not impaired.
Yeah, I don't think just because you're intoxicated puts you into a new category. I mean, we arrest drunk drivers, put them in jail, treat them just like everyone else on a daily basis. And, you know, I didn't see Mr. Rawlis stagger. I didn't see him slur his words when he addressed the officers. And for the purposes of the record, because the officers didn't rely on it in any way, we didn't include any of the post mortem findings because they simply didn't know about it.
Well, but they call to 911. He's here and he's drunk and it's going to get ugly.
That's what the wife said. Correct. Yes. So
is there a problem for your case that Officer Gardner not only shot Mr. Rawlis when he was holding the hammer up, but shot him after he had come down towards the floor? What about that last shot?
Yeah, he Mr. Rawlis did go to a kneeling position and groaned, but he still had the hammer kind of up by his head, posed as he was crouched down. And that's what led Officer Gardner to fire one more shot, because the hammer could still be lodged. They had no way of knowing that they had already fatally shot him. I mean, that last shot is within a second or two of the first volley of shots that put Mr. Rawlis into the squatting position.
Can I ask you, I want to go back just a little bit in your colloquy with Judge McHugh. So they're about 8 feet away in the garage. You're saying that because a hammer, the claw side of a hammer could be extraordinarily dangerous, and it is reasonable to anticipate deadly force being used against Officer Gardner. Wasn't exactly the same true in Ceballos? After all, I think according to the majority opinion, they were 10 to 12 feet from Mr. Ceballos. He wasn't holding a gun. He was holding a baseball bat. Obviously, no baseball bat can extend 10 to 12 feet. And they weren't also enclosed like they were here, so that they could have retreated. They could have increased the distance. And yet the majority found not only that there was a constitutional violation, but that it was a violation of clearly established constitutional right to fire holding a baseball bat. And so why doesn't Ceballos, based on its interpretation of Allen, provide the clearly established source for a violation of them shooting when Mr. Rawlis had raised the hammer?
Two things. First of all, of course, the Ceballos versus Hess case couldn't have put anyone on notice in 2016 just because.
But it certainly, but that's why I say it was based on the interpretation of Allen, which did precede this.
Right. And early on, I think you asked Mr. Blakemore some questions that touched on that. You know, in both Allen and the Hess case, I mean, we know we're going to deal with somebody who's deranged or dangerous and has a dangerous instrumentality. We don't know that. The danger does not arise in this case until all three officers are inside the garage and Mr. Rawlis goes to the workbench, grabs a hammer, turns around and confronts him. So that's the factual difference that sets this case apart from the other two cases. And if no one has any other questions, that will conclude my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Blakemore, you have 25 seconds, I believe.
I'll use these 25 seconds just to reiterate, and this is from Casilla versus Hughes, Supreme Court case, that the clearly established law prong does not require a case directly on point for the right to be clearly established. And I think that the existing authority that we cited is sufficiently put them on notice that this was unconstitutional. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your arguments this morning. This case will be submitted. Counsel are excused.